after we get done with the wireframe, and by the way, I do not spend an awful lot of time on the wireframe. What I'm really trying to do is just extract more detail from the client. What do you want? Because I'll tell you, I found a lot of times that I had one client who said, what we want is a content management system. And in talking with them, I had a very brief conversation with them, and then I put together a very quick little wireframe. It took me about 2 hours to do. And they go, well, where do we enter in the people? And I said, you mean the users? They said, yeah, the people that we want to work with. And it turned out that what they wanted was a contact management system. So
those buzzwords will kill you every time.
It's very true. So having the, we go from this wireframe, which as I say, I don't spend a lot of time on, because I'm really only trying to take a first pass, get a really rough draft about what people want. And by the way, people can change anything during this. If they said content, they really mean contact. I don't tell them you bozos. I'd be like, that kind of content. I understand now. But now we go to the crucial part, the part that I've said many times, if I could only control one aspect of a project, it would be this. It's the prototype. Because this is where we communicate with clients. The clients say to us, we want such and such. And instead of writing down a note or sending an email or writing 100-page requirement documents, we show them what we interpret their words to mean. And we hold it up to them and we go, like this? Mm-hmm. And the client responds. Now, when you give the client a prototype, what is the first thing they're going to start looking at?
Well, the first thing you look at is just the visual impact, what it looks like. I mean, how does it make you feel? Before you recognize any words or anything, there's an emotional impact that's kind of an interesting thing to watch. You can almost see it from across the room when something is first presented. It's almost like being in an art museum. You get that first glance at mm-hmm. something, and there's sort of this visceral reaction, and it's either, oh, that's wonderful, or that's what we're going to use.
That's not exactly
right. And so it can be a very interesting moment.
And that look and feel part is hugely important to clients. To us, we go like when I first started doing this, I would tell clients, well, don't worry about what it looks like, but just tell me the functionality.
But that's wireframe.
That's exactly right. And that's not what, I mean, you might as well try to get, your kids to do homework before they play. And yes, in a perfect world that would happen. But in reality, what happens is the clients look and they see, could the buttons be more rounded? And instead of, I've learned after many, many failures, that instead of saying, well, don't worry about the buttons right now, I go back and I change the buttons and I say, you mean like this? And I show them rounded buttons. And if that isn't what they're looking for, they're going to let me know. And we're going to deal with those, to developers, what seem like really silly issues. Could it be more like cornflour and less like slate? Absolutely. You mean like this? And so I'm iterating over this prototype time and time again. Now,
but developer dollars are expensive.
Oh, you just read my mind.
Well, so we really don't want developers to be doing this prototyping thing.
We don't for two reasons, or maybe three reasons, or maybe a myriad of reasons. One of them is that developer dollars are expensive. Second reason, developers aren't very good at this stuff.
I know I'm not.
No, I've heard developers say, hey, if I wanted to go through all that soft, warm, feely stuff, I'd become a social worker. But there are people that are really good for it, good at it, rather. They're client liaisons. And honestly, in my experience, women tend to do a much better job of that. They tend to be much more empathetic to the client. And again, the whole point of this is that this is the natural process by which clients find out what they want. Now, we have a pejorative name for it. We call it scope creep. Right? The client looks at it and they go, could we add this to it? But the important thing to understand is, we aren't doing this in code.
When we haven't defined scope yet, we're still defining the whole scope.
Right.
Scope can't creep until you've said, this is what the scope is. And I think that's one of the one of the reasons that that's kind of become a debate within the Fusebox community is, you know, is it scope creep or is it not scope creep? Or we, how is it that Steve Nelson says we're befriending scope creep, or we're harnessing scope creep, some whatever that way he refers to it. But to me, scope creep is never an issue with Flip in that we don't lock down scope until way beyond the point where it would have been a problem in a traditional design life cycle.
Absolutely. And people are really shocked when they work with me and I show them how long the requirements phase, the design phase, goes on before any code gets written. It's because the number one reason that projects fail is clients tell us the software doesn't do what we want it to do. And then we get, well, gee, if they would only tell us, they can't tell us. If they could tell us, they would. And if they could tell us, they wouldn't need us. They could hire 16-year-olds to build this stuff.
My favorite example of a failed design document, I'm sure you've seen this, is Spinal Tap.
Yes.
My very favorite is the pagan Stonehenge monument prop that's, they note down, that's to be 18 feet tall, but on the scribble on the napkin it's 18 inches, and it makes its debut in concert and it comes out and there's this little foot and a half tall stone thing, and everyone's sort of standing around looking at it like, what is that? Could have been easily rectified if it had been modeled and they'd said, well, so you want it about this high, right? And so, what, are you out of your mind?
Yeah, well, that's really true. Given that, we're talking about, we don't want developers doing this, right?
Right.
Because they're expensive, because they really don't do a good job. This is not what they signed up for.
Absolutely.
What they signed up for was they developers enjoy the inner structure of things. Mm-hmm. But when you're in a prototype phase, the front-end first phase, you aren't working with code. You aren't working with code at all. And there are great tools for doing this, one of which would be Macromedia's Dreamweaver. Right? You want to have designers doing this stuff, or UI people if you're lucky enough to have those folks working with you. But you don't want developers, because the other reason, maybe the most important, is that developers will want to cut this process short. They'll this is sort of like eating your vegetables, you know, eat your Brussels sprouts or your spinach. They'll go along with it for a little bit, but after a while they go like, enough of this stuff. We want to do the real work. And let's, the real work is,
let's get on with it.
Let's start coding.
That's right.
Right? That's the real work.
That's right.
Well, in Flip, that's not the real work. The real work,
you heretic.
Exactly. The real work is, let's figure this stuff out. Let's find out what clients want. Let's give them a process by which that natural evolution of what they want, you know, figuring out what they want, can occur. And once we know how to do that, then we can start architecting and coding it. Until then, the only kind of coding that I'm doing is what I call R&D coding. The client has an idea, and I want to try out some stuff. I remember I had one for an entertainment network where they wanted to set up a system by which their producers could enter things about Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all that sort of thing. And so while we were developing what they wanted, I wanted to try out some things, and so I did a little R&D coding, and that's the kind of stuff that I do. No database schema stuff. I just want, because, and here's the thing, I had a friend who taught the Royal Thai Navy, he was one of their instructors, and he told me about modern aircraft, which you'll know a lot more than I do. But he was explaining to me that, unlike a big jetliner, if you cut the power off of an F-18 or something,
a fighter, like, sure,
it'll fall right like a rock out of the sky.
Brick. Sure.
And I thought, well, that seems so odd. And he says, no, because they don't want to have any, I don't know if it's called inertia or what, I'm sure there's some term for it. But in other words, they want it as flexible as possible. And so by not having it sort of a natural course that it takes, the fact that it's essentially just a powered rock, mm-hmm, it can be extremely maneuverable.
Absolutely.
And I thought about this, this is kind of like the prototype. if we start architecting this thing, if we start putting code, and God forbid if we start putting a database into this thing, when the client gets a certain point at this process and they go like, oh my gosh, that won't work at all, that we are going to resist that because we have already invested work, mental effort, time, money, code, and we can't afford that. We need to have that enormous flexibility. We need to be like a fighter jet and be able to turn on a dime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good analogy. I was kind of even thinking about the difference between cigarette boats and cruise liners.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever seen any kind of large ship or mm-hmm. super tankers for that matter, mm-hmm. those things take miles upon miles to stop once underway. And I think that's a great illustration, just because what the whole process of flip does is create a series of steps that are increasingly complex. So start with very little bit of inertia and add mass to the project, if you will, as it goes along, so that it becomes increasingly more difficult to turn as you get later into the project. But in the early stages, it's very lightweight, easy to turn, without great expense.
Absolutely. And this is as I said, if I could only control one aspect of the whole project, this is what I would control.
So did your very large corporation do a prototype?
Absolutely. And they spent months doing the prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And they did two things wrong.
Okay.
They did not do a full prototype. In other words, they did representative pages.
Okay.
And they never set the client down in front of it. They showed it to the client.
Wow.
They had meetings and they projected it on a screen and they explained to them how they would be doing this. And the clients, as you would expect, nodded, yep, that looks right. That would do what we need to do. Not that's how we want to do it, but I guess that would work. But there was not the full prototype. It was only a few representative pages. Well, actually, it was quite a few representative pages. But the point of a prototype is that the client should not be able to distinguish it from the real working application.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I take that with a little grain of salt, because there are some things that a prototype, for example, if you're trying to simulate, and that's what we're doing with a prototype, for example, data entry, chances are very good that the client can only enter in certain things.
Right.
Right. Because what we want is to, the next page they go to, they see their entry show up. But this is really almost like more like building a Hollywood movie than it is building a skyscraper. Because what we want is the semblance of reality.
The appearance, sure.
Right, but not the thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do this. They did not do a full, so that it was did not engage the client fully. The client never had the sense. Can you imagine if you're watching a movie, if the assistant director walked through the scene, or you can see the microphone boom, or the trash.
I've seen movies like that.
No, you have, right? Yeah, really sure. Bad movies like yeah. That. It completely breaks the illusion.
Sure.
And what we need is for the client to be so involved that they are now using the software. Right? All right, now. As we're going through this extremely iterative process, and I can't really stress that enough, that every time the client tells us something, we actually make a change. We don't just make a note. So how do clients tell us what they want? How do they respond to the prototype? We use dev notes or something like dev notes. And Jeff, you are a big fan of dev notes.
I'm a huge fan of dev notes. And dev notes are one of the better things you've ever come up with. The whole idea of dev notes is just to have a little interactive forum, if you will, that appears at the bottom of the prototype page that allows you to identify yourself by initials or some short name or string and enter a comment about the page. And this becomes a hierarchical tree of comments, so you can have replies to comments and so forth that are all associated with the page in the prototype. I personally like the concept so much that I use it in my test directory when I have pages that I'm fiddling with or commenting on this comes in real handy when I'm preparing for writing a book, for example, and I do tests on various approaches or bits of code, ways to do things, and I can enter comments into my database of notes about how to do things in DevNotes. So I just drop a DevNotes call in onRequestN.cfm in my test directory. And so anything I run in the test directory automatically has a DevNotes forum at the bottom of it. It's a great concept. So we put that into the prototype. Now the prototype's still HTML, right?
Right.
So we're not.
Right.
So in order to implement DevNotes, we kind of have to fool things and change our extensions to .cfm and then put in an onRequestN.
Right.
So that we can turn on DevNotes.
And then DevNotes is a simple custom tag that you can download from your site, GrokFuseBox.
GrokFuseBox.com.
And it's just a custom tag, and it provides a threaded, you know, messaging, as you were saying. It goes into a database. Now, let's say that the client calls me, and they go, "Hal, I've been thinking. You know what we really should do on that product description page is we should have a link to other products that people might be interested in." And I'll go, "You know, that's a great idea. Are you by a web browser?" And let's say they say yes. I go, "Would you mind going to this URL?" And I will send them right to the prototype. So you see that little thing at the bottom of the page? Would you just type in just what you said? Because I don't want to forget. I don't want to do anything that would cost you time or money, which is pretty hard to argue with. And so the client will type it in, and what I'm doing is I'm training them. Every time they tell me, if I'm with them, I'll say, "Let's go to a web browser," and I'll open up the web browser. I say, "Would you mind typing that in?" Now, once we get that done, again, remember my whole big thing is, you mean like this, as I show the new prototype to the client. So once that's done, once I've added in those upsell items or something like that, and the client, and I've got the client to say, "Yes, this is exactly what I mean," there's a little X button on that thread that I can click, and it removes it from the DevNotes, but not from the database. Right? So we have a record of how we arrived at these decisions, but this iterative process is enormously helpful at capturing what people want and getting back to them within a day or 2 days, because we're not writing code, we're not talking to a database, we're not doing anything other than saying, "You mean like this?"
But where does it all end?
It ends at prototype freeze.
Okay.
And prototype freeze is a point devoutly to be hoped for. It's when the client can say to me, "You have shown me everything that I expect to see, and everything that you have shown me is correct."
But I have a client who will tell me that the very first time I show him anything.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go through it, and he'll say, "That's great. That's wonderful. Go do it."
Well, there's two aspects to this. For okay. The other thing that you have to have prototype freeze is that the architect, you, have to say to the client, "You have given me everything I need to complete this project." That would mean, if we're talking about an e-commerce site, it means that you've given me a database of products, whatever it is that I needed to complete the job, and that I'm convinced that we're ready to start this project.
So prototype freeze is an agreement between the architect and the client, that the client is satisfied that the architect understands what they want, and the architect is satisfied that the client has given them everything they need to do the project.
Absolutely right.
Okay, so what do we do then? How do we signify all of this? We write up a big contract that says
that has a bunch of words.
Right,
to it.
Yeah, right. About 150 pages. We hire John Edwards to come in and
litigate it.
Right.
No, but before we talk about how we actually formalize this, let me say that in my experience, clients always think we're ready to go far before I think we're ready to go. It may be as bad as your client who says, "Yep, that looks great." Well, I can guarantee that in 78% of cases where that happens, when we actually deliver the product, the client will then say to us, as they see the now deployed application, gee, you know what would be nice? So I'm not going to allow that to occur. I'm going to resist, because I've also often said that having a project that being the project manager is like raising a child, or it's like being a guide. You know, you've got these people, naive people, business people who want to get from from point A to point B. And it's my job to get them there. It's not my job to follow their directions, because if they could get themselves there, they wouldn't need me. We have a very famous example of a guide who was persuaded against his better judgment to depart from the path that he knew was safe and go on the client's idea of a better path that would take them there shorter and faster. You know what that was?
And this would be?
That would be the Donner Party.
The Donner Party.
Wow. Yes, and this is exactly what happened, is that some of the members said, well, that takes too long. Let's see if we can't find a shortcut. And the guide, against his better judgment, decided, okay, well, I'll go along with them because, you know, they may have a point and they certainly are going to need me. And what ended up happening was that they got stranded, they got lost, and they ended up running out of food and actually eating each other. So it's become now this sort of byword of failed projects, you know. Well, so if we're going to get the clients safely there, we have to understand that prototype freeze should not be lightly entered into, because when we do enter into prototype freeze, nothing changes from that point on.
So we have a responsibility as the guide in your example. The architect has the responsibility to ensure that the project has a safe path ahead.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I was working on a very large project for an e-commerce retailer, and this project was up against a hard deadline. We had the Super Bowl, where we were having ads in the paper, the AOL, they were doing a big advertising, you know, multi-million dollar advertising budget, so this could not slip. We had 7 months to complete the project. No coding occurred, other than R&D type coding, until month 7. Now, at this point, by month 5, people were saying to me, Hal, surely we're ready to start with this thing. And I was thinking, yeah, we probably got to be ready to start. And I happened to take out to the Joe, the guy in the warehouse who was going to fulfill these orders, an email that was going to send him when we got a new order to alert him. And of course, it fed into their back-end system and all that. This is month 5, right? We've been going through many iterations. I've got complete cooperation from the C-level folks, right? The CIO, CTO, CEO, all that kind of stuff. And I haven't neglected the secretary. I just tried to do this right. Thought I knew everything. Joe tells me, yeah, that'll work fine for a D order. And I went, a D order? He goes, yeah, that'll be good for a D order. I said, what's a D order? He goes, that's one that we deliver ourselves. I said, well, are there other orders? He goes, yeah, there's U and O orders. I said, what's a U order? He goes, oh, that would be like a UPS delivery, where we're not actually going to have our trucks come there. Or there's an O other, which is an other order. In other words, it's a partner of ours. This is the first time in 5 months anyone had mentioned this to me. To make matters worse, each purchase order, or each order number, rather, that came in got broken into up to 3 separate orders, which meant that if clients ever wanted to return anything, we had to associate these 3 orders with their order. None of this had come out. Now, I'm utterly convinced, had we not gone through that whole lengthy process, had we not given the necessary time to discover this thing, we would have had a $1.7 million failure.
Absolutely. I can just imagine you having an operational system that comes out and works fine for the first 5 orders that all happen to be D's, and then somebody sends through a U order and poof.
And unbelievable that this had not come up. And I assure you, we'd had many, many meetings, and it was mind-boggling to me. But this is the sort of thing that I have learned over time. It's my job to restrain it. I know the kids want to go out and play in the street, but somebody has to say, that's not a good idea. And you have to do it tactfully, and you have to do it respectfully, but you can't let clients run the project, or they will run it into the ground, and then everyone loses. Right? Mm-hmm. So prototype freeze, how do we formalize it? So we get to a point where now I really and truly am as convinced as I can, you know, be.
Reasonably be.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. That we're ready to go. And remember I said that I have been getting people to use dev notes all this time.
Right.
What I'm going to do at this point is to, I've already explained to the clients that we have this milestone called a prototype freeze. And that up to that point, they can make any change they want to. There's no resistance at all. Now, if I think they're going off the rails, because somebody has to, again, somebody has to be there to guide them, then I'm going to help them to discover that. I'm not going to tell them no. I'm going to explain to them the issues. I had one client who wanted to do a very cool little simulation with a Java applet. Although I knew it was not going to be a good idea, rather than say, no, it's a bad idea, I investigated, I explored it, and I found a company that could do it. They made a presentation. It was going to cost a lot of money, which was not a problem. But I asked the company, as they were presenting it, how big is this applet? And they told me. And I asked the business folks, who is your target customer? And they said, why, it's an AOL user coming in on a 28.8 modem. And I said, about how long would it take, going back to the other company now, to download this applet? And they said, probably 57 minutes. And I said,
an hour?
Would that be acceptable? I said to the business folks who were horrified, and of course, no.
Well, of course.
I said, well, that's such a good idea. Why don't we keep that for version 2? Right, so I don't want to tell them no, because then that turns into a match between, you know, who's got the most power and who's got the most clout.
Sure.
All right. So
who pays the bills?
Absolutely right. And if the client pays the bill, they want to believe that they can do anything they want, and I will say, yes, I agree, you can do anything you want, but we can't defy laws of physics.
Right.
So okay. But we get to this point now where we really believe that we've know everything that we need to know.
Checked all the boxes. Yep. We think everything's right. Okay.
Now we're going to go to prototype freeze. And what happens in prototype freeze is that these dev notes that I have assiduously been getting people to use get removed.
They're just gone.
They're gone.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. Now, at that point, once we remove the dev notes, and then I print out with a color laser printer each of the individual prototype pages. And then I, back from my days as a woodworker, when I was working with architects, in order to communicate, did I understand what the architect meant? Did the architect understand what I meant? I would create shop drawings, and I would submit these shop drawings, which are, you know, full details of the cabinets and that sort of thing, to the architect. They would stamp the shop drawings with an architect stamp that basically said approved, rejected, approved as noted. Now I removed the approved as noted because I don't want that sort of thing appearing. I want either yes, this is right, or no, this is not right. Mm-hmm. And I sign this, and the client signs this. Now, Jeff, you've actually made stamps.
Yeah, right? I use a rubber stamp that says design approved, and then it has a line that says client and an underline, and architect and an underline, and we go through and stamp them. Now, I wanted to back up for just a second and ask you, when you go through and you print out all of those pages, how do you do that? That's got to be pretty time-consuming.
Yes, it is. And I may have 200 pages.
I have a little tool on my site. I got really fed up with going to, you know, click a page, print a page, click a page, print a page, because my time is expensive.
I'm glad one of ours is.
And so I put together a little utility. All you have to do is give it a text file that has a URL on each line, mm-hmm. and it will use IE to go to the URL, take a screenshot, save it as a bitmap file.
Excellent idea.
And particularly if you have if you use a file manager like Total Commander or one of those that lets you capture all of the file names.
Oh, you can do that?
In a directory. Or you can even use DOS. You can do a directory command piped into a text file.
Right.
Then you can stick your HTTP prefix in front of all the file names, and then that gives you your text file. But at any rate, it's on grokfusebox.com in Grok's goodies, and the descriptions will tell you how to use it. And basically, I just fire that off and then go do something else that's more important. So that's a big time. So anyway, we get all these pages printed out. Yep. We stamp them.
Yeah. Now I will say, I maybe take, we'll see if you do it this way too, but I'm such a nut about this that I literally stamp every single page.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and I have, yeah. Even though that may mean 200 signatures.
Yeah.
I the reason for it is that I really want this to be a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a formal meeting with the client. Now, do you ever run into a situation where the client goes, "Look, I'm not going to sign this"?
Yeah, I had that once, and it was kind of an interesting situation. It fortunately was a client that we'd done a lot of work with before, and it was just a matter of kind of, going through the process and saying, this is our agreement that we understand each other. I could see with a new client where it might be a little bit uncomfortable.
And that's why I explained to them the process, because this is sort of the zenith of this road that we're going over, and I need clients to understand that this is a big deal, and that's why I ritualize the thing, and that's one of the very first things I talked about. When I have a first meeting with the client, I want to know, are they going to be willing to go along with this process? Because if they're not, I'm not willing to roll the dice and take a chance that we're going to have a failure. But this happened to a client of a developer that I was working with, and he sent me an email, and he said that what he found out when he asked the client to sign off on it was that when the client wouldn't do it, it was because they were not the real decision maker.
They didn't have the authority.
Exactly right. That's extremely important to understand. Now, hopefully you would have found that out before that point, right? But I've gone through that whole get the decision makers and all that. And sometimes, because people don't want to lose face or whatever, they may represent themselves as being the people who are in charge, when in reality, they're not. They really... they may titularly have that ability and that power, but the truth is that the CEO needs to sign off on it. And if that's the case, we need to find that out before we write code, or else we will kid ourselves and think that we've got everything all set, and then we'll get to deploy the project, and then the CEO will say, "You know what would be nice?
That's really nice, but it doesn't do what we need it to do."
Yeah, and everybody else may agree, "Oh no, it works perfectly." Mm-hmm. If the CEO is the guy that you have to satisfy,
right.
And having them sign that will get you... Now, this is not for legal purposes.
No.
If it has to go to that, everybody's lost anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right?
But this is to create a ritual. And the other part of that ritual is removing the dev notes. Because I've had clients... after we've signed off on it, they'll go back to the prototype and they'll have a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And sure.
They'll call me up. They go, "Hal,
where are the dev notes?"
Yeah, and I go like, "They're gone." And you go like, "How do I enter a new idea or a comment?" I go like, "I don't know. There's nowhere dev notes." And even though you would think the client could say, like, "Well, put the damn things back on," they don't. It's a ritual that they, and it's very, very important not to break that ritual. Because if for any reason, I'm not going to say that there's never a point, I've run into situations where I had to, but let's say that I had a client one time who said, "We have to change the paragraph." I charged them $12,000 to change a paragraph.
And why? They paid it?
Absolutely. It was a very big project. Why? Because I could. No, because it was extremely important that we keep this barrier. Now, conversely, I've had times where I've screwed up, and we have to, what I think Steve Nelson was the first guy I heard calling it, a thawing the prototype.
Thawing the prototype. Right?
If you freeze the prototype, then you thaw the prototype. It's a good term.
Thaw the prototype.
And I've had to do it. And when I do it, I make a big deal of embarrassing myself in front of the client and telling them that I screwed up. And that I never should have frozen the prototype because of blah, blah, blah. Now, it may be a little thing. And honestly, the client, I haven't had to do it very often, but the clients are always like, okay, is that a big deal? And I go, yes, it's a very big deal. I should not have done this. This is really very bad. And it's important because if I can do it, Jeff, they can do it.
Right.
So once we have arrived at prototype freeze, we signed off on it, we printed it out, the dev notes are gone, that's the point at which I want to architect the application.
Okay. Well, we've now spent well over 80% of our allotted time getting to this point in the process. So I think that's fair. So when we come back, then we can talk about the remaining 20% starting with our architecture.
Good.